Sourcing Matters podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. We've spent a great deal of time on Sourcing Matters discussing proper natural resource management, especially that of land and soil management. But as many of our avid listeners can attest, there's been a common theme which has arisen in the last, probably last 20, 25 conversations with diverse experts in the field, and that is of land access. And that theme is something that we haven't fully explored on the show. As Mark Twain explained, buy land. They're not making it anymore. In fact, with sea level rise and flooding of low-lying areas often used for growing crops, we're losing ground around the globe quickly. Throw in detrimental agricultural practice that mines fertility and regenerative natural resources, and an addiction to synthetics that maximize output but corrupt long-term viability, and sweetwater contamination, we've got some serious stuff to deal with in our food production venues. Now, we've learned that conversations and actions about land access must run in parallel with discussions about evolving our management practice to be more ecologically responsible operating systems. Together, we can address the intensifying problem of the loss of production land to synthetics and to residential development and urban sprawl, often referred to as the last crop. Stateside, we're losing this essential and often overlooked asset of farmland natural resources to development at an alarming rate. Over time, the expansion of cities and suburbs are responsible for the most loss of farmland. But between 1992 and 2012, 41% of lost acres came from the development in rural areas. 62% of new development took place on agricultural land. And the remaining 38% was mostly in forest and natural space, which are essential for farming and production of food in conjunction. During that 20-year period, in total, 31 million acres of farmland was lost to development. Now that's 175 acres per hour of agricultural land lost to development, or 3 acres per minute. Of those lost acres, 11 million were some of America's best agricultural lands. Representing only 4.5% of global population, the U.S. has over 10% of arable lands. And for the American Midwest, the San Joaquin Valley, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and the global gold mine of Iowa, the United States has, or maybe I should say had, some of the most fertile soils in the world. The ripple effect in us determining how and what we do to produce food around the world is unquestionable. No doubt our government and many American companies are responsible for spawning these detrimental agricultural practices which have scaled around the world. So, can we turn the ship around? Can we innovate to better utilize, engage, and preserve the bounty of natural resources we've inherited? And can we reteach a shrinking planet how to grow food more in line with natural order? And will they listen? Well, today we welcome a guest, an expert in the field, to shed some light on the changing face of America's farmland and production agriculture. Today we welcome the president and CEO of American Farmland Trust, John Piatti. Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm fine. Great to be here, Aaron.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. Up from Washington, D.C., on the way up to Maine?
Up to Maine. That's home.
That's home state of Maine. Mm-hmm. What part of Maine?
A little town called Unity in central Maine. A lot of people who are involved with food and farming know it because it's the site of something called the Common Ground Fair, which is a big event happening every fall, which is a wonderful celebration of food and rural living.
It is. Talk about some good agro-tourism right there, right?
Indeed.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about American Farmland Trust. And I do want to talk more about your background, what got you here, but let's start there. So
sure.
Just so our listening audience know more about what these big problems that you're solving here. So American Farmland Trust, or AFT, is an organization that works to protect and conserve farmland throughout the United States, headquartered in Washington, D.C., and launched in 1980, AFT is staffed and governed by farmers, policy experts, researchers, and scientists. and with a call to action of join the movement, save the family farms, stay informed, American Farmland Trust seeks to engage diverse stakeholders in evaluating what will happen to the nation's food supply if we continue to wastefully develop our best farmland and ranch land. So, John, could you please tell us a bit more about what you're up to in the American Farmland Trust?
Sure. Well, as you said, we've been around since 1980, and I will spend a moment talking about our history because it really helps helps the viewer understand what we do and why we do it. We were formed because in the late 1970s, really the first time in this nation, we began to wonder whether we would have adequate land to serve our needs of food production in the future. And there was a blue ribbon panel that government put forward. But at the same time, there was an increasing interest within private nonprofits that we needed to apply some of the tools of conservation that were emerging to farmland. And Peggy Rockefeller, who was herself an avid farmer with large holdings in the Hudson Valley, may have been married to one of the richest people in the world, but she was at heart very much of a farm girl. And she, at the time, actually served on the board of the Nature Conservancy in the mid-70s and said, we need to do something to apply these emerging tools of conservation to farming. And TNC said, that's not what we do. We're in another sphere. Well, being Peggy Rockefeller, what she did is went out, brought together this amazing brain trust of people, including the president of TNC, who she stole away, and a few others, and they created, or they started by exploring what the needs were, but ultimately created AFT. And the reason I mention that history is because 40 years ago, it's easy to forget that the landscape was different. We think all the time now about protecting farmland with permanent agricultural conservation easements. Back 40 years ago, they existed, but were used in a very, very limited way. And AFT wrote into federal law that these tools of agricultural conservation easements could be utilized, that they would be acceptable for IRS tax donations, and that changed the game. And as a result of both changes in federal law and then a proactive work to go out and make sure that there were state farmland protection programs, there were private land trusts like the one I ran in Maine for many years, Maine Farmland Trust, which AFT helped create. AFT, through these activities, created a movement. And we sometimes refer to it as the conservation agriculture movement. And it has resulted now in the permanent protection of 6.5 million acres of farmland. But, and this will be of interest to you, Aaron, given your knowledge of soil health. From the beginning, though, for AFT, it was not just about protecting the land with a permanent easement. The view of the visionaries who created AFT was from the beginning, if you protect land with an easement, but if all your topsoil is washing into the local stream, you really haven't served the goal of that easement, which is to make sure that land will always be available for farming. So pretty much from the beginning, we also had a focus on soil health. It helped that Norm Berg, who is a legendary chief of NRCS, when he retired from USDA in 1982, he came to work as a volunteer for AFT. He worked for us for the next 26 years. And as a result, many of the amazing innovations that led to the creation of the first conservation title in the Farm Bill in 1985, be it the Conservation Reserve Program, EQIP, the Farmland Protection Program, all of these things, the brainchild for them was AFT. We teed it up and made it happen. So from the beginning, it was about the land, it was about the practices, and not surprisingly, we realized as an organization that we also had to focus on the people. Again, you could have the land protected, you could be following good practices, but somebody has to do it. So there's been a focus from the beginning on the farmers and ranchers who steward our land. And so that's it in a nutshell. We are about the land, the practices, and the people who do the work. And it sounds fairly simple, but for national organizations, there are none other working in the agricultural space that take this holistic perspective. Agriculture, as you know, is big and broad, and most of the national organizations focus on a narrow piece of it. They're about corn, or maybe they're about young farmers. All these areas need attention, but it is a system. So what AFT brings to the whole discussion is this systemic look, this holistic view. And we do that through a whole bunch of research. We do it through demonstration projects, and we do it through very active engagement in public policy, both federal and state.
It is fascinating when you take a step back and realize I'm about a 45-year-old dude, right? I'm approaching my 45th birthday. But when you step back and realize that in our lifetime, the global population has doubled. And I remember campaigns as a kid when, you know, the crying Native American about the litter. That was the biggest issue then.
Yes, I remember that commercial.
Right, of course.
Sure.
Actually, being like an Italian guy, by the
way. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Joe something. But nonetheless, the fact that those things still stick with us, right? Those kind of, they have a place in our mind of maybe it was an engagement points for us to care about these things.
Yeah.
But in our lifetime, the fact that these major problems are really on the precipice of just drastic change and the loss of land, the poor utilization or management of land is becoming, you know, I think almost a front and center with a lot of people's day-to-day lives. At first, there used to be a fringe element here to it, and now I think it's becoming more general. And we're seeing it in the mainstream media about the concerns of plastics in the oceans, about the loss of soil down the Mississippi.
Right.
And I mean, I guess it has to be an awareness part of that. Do you spend a lot of time at American Farmland Trust talking about awareness?
We do, and we're really trying to get more and more people to recognize that we're losing our land at a truly alarming rate. You mentioned some of the statistics earlier. Last 20 years, 31 million acres, that is the equivalent of all the farmland in Iowa, 3 acres a minute. So it is at a fast rate. But I'll tell you, the challenge when you dig into these numbers with people is you will throw those out. They sound big. But in truth, we do have a huge amount of farmland in this nation. I would argue it's truly our greatest resource. As you mentioned, we have 10% of the arable land on this entire planet right here in this country. So even though the numbers seem big, I hear all the time people rebut that with, well, yes, but there's still plenty of land. Or, well, it's a shame that we're losing farmland, but you know, we're a developed nation. It's natural. It's going to happen. It's inevitable. There'll be other places in the world where we can grow our food. But if you really understand these numbers, you'll realize that this is an irreplaceable resource. It's a global resource, not just a national resource. And we need to take really active steps to make sure we have it in the future. Some people ask me, how much land are we going to need in the future to maintain our society? And the truth is, we don't really know. Nobody's taken that kind of assessment. But lately, I've been pushing back. We've been undertaking this big national farm inventory, a study we call Farms Under Threat. You can get more detail on our website. It's truly the most comprehensive look at land use in the United States that's ever been undertaken. And it's basically this there to figure out how fast we're losing land. And one of the things we learned, you alluded to it in the opening comments, we're losing farmland faster than we thought because it's not just urban sprawl. It's also what's happening in rural areas. You don't notice it as much because it happens over a period of time. The 100 acres that turn into 200 houses, you see. The 100 acres that over 10 years gets broken up 10 times basically gets removed from ever being used from practical agriculture, but happens in a different manner, and you don't notice it. We've been doing this study for a while, and what I hear people say is, how much land do we really need? And our next step in that research is to begin to figure that out. But I'll tell you this, I push back sometimes and I say, maybe we don't have enough farmland today. And people will say, what? Well, of course we do. We're all eating. In fact, we export all this and we're using some of it for ethanol that some people wonder why we do that. Of course we have plenty of farmland. And I say, well, yes, but consider this. What if we had appropriate riparian buffers around all the land. So there was no sediments that were flowing into rivers and streams. What if we were following best farming practices on all the rest of the land? So we were using proper rotations. We were using cover crops adequately. What if we were not pushing and having production on the most marginal land and allowing some of that to grow back into woodland or native grasses?
Sure.
Then beyond that, what if we were managing all of that so that we were at a minimum that agriculture was carbon neutral? If we were managing that property to sequester a lot of carbon. And then you could take it even further, because we know there are sectors of the economy that are never going to be able to be carbon neutral on their own. Maybe agriculture has to play a bigger role. If you start looking at those kind of numbers, I'd posit that maybe we don't even have enough farmland today. That's the next wave of research that AFT is going to get into.
I love it. It's we often focus on the idea of solutions of change, mm-hmm. right? And we take, no doubt, agriculture as a net loss. It's pulling resources. It's extractive. It takes a lot of materials, a lot of products to do things. We have 40% waste in the food supply mm-hmm. chain. Mm-hmm. We've got all these detrimental practices, exposés. We're trying to shift that paradigm. And similar to you, and talk about the fact of, well, let's look differently. What if you could sink all that carbon right into agricultural land? What if we put pastures down and ruminants back out in open pasture, mm-hmm, not mm-hmm. just for food production, but for, you know, anti-desertification models?
Exactly, exactly.
Boy, then we could curate more opportunity in the future. Mm. I think that's really exciting that an organization like yours is looking differently, because it extends not just what's in arable lands and, mm-hmm. and crop production, which mm-hmm. many people think of, but it gets all of the surrounding areas
exactly.
and the communities and everything. That's that and common lands, shared state lands. That's great. So this is your third year, heading into your third year.
About 2.5 years.
About 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've heard a little bit about the establishment of AFT. Since you've taken over the helm, what are some of the good and bad things you've seen, and what has changed over that time frame?
Mm. Well, a big focus of our activities in the last couple of years since I've taken over has really been on what we can do in our area to advance better farming practices, specifically with an eye towards sequestering carbon and helping combat climate change. I left the best job I'd ever had in my life. Maine is a wonderful state. It's my home. I ran a great organization that I'm very proud of. We were doing great work, protecting farmland, doing a lot of work, getting young farmers on the land. And we can talk about land access later. It's a topic is near and dear to my heart. But what we weren't doing in that work at the level that I really wanted to professionally is jump into this issue of farming practices. And I was recruited by AFT, and what sold me on, they had to convince me hard because I did leave the best job I've ever had and a place I love. But they convinced me. The chair of the board was very persuasive. And he said, John, you care deeply about these issues. You know what farming can do to help restore our planet. And we're offering you a vehicle where you can help us take that to the next level while you fulfill something that's really important to yourself. And so a huge focus of our efforts in the last couple of years, they recruited me knowing that that's what I wanted to do, and they wanted me to do it. So we've really been upping the ante on that. And we've been involved with soil health for almost 40 years. I'll tell you, 35 years ago, when we were helping farmers build soil health, it was for the purposes of reducing nutrient loss and reducing pollution and building organic matter for the purposes of increasing productivity. Those are the same practices that also sequester carbon. But 35 years ago, as an organization, AFT wasn't thinking about that. Now it's a front and center issue. And it's amazed me that this has become an issue literally in the last couple of years. If you look at the 2015 Paris Accords, there was barely any mention of agriculture as part of the solution. Last year, the IPPP came out with a new study that basically said there's no way we can reach the Paris climate goals unless we focus on what they refer to as natural solutions, of which I'd argue agriculture is the one that's been most overlooked and where there's the most opportunity. So a big part of the focus of the last 2.5 years has been setting us up as an organization to work in that space. And some of it has been easy because we've been at this game for a long time. Some of it has been a challenge because an organization, AFT is a strange beast. We've got 1 foot in the ag community, 1 foot in the environmental community. We're a little of both, but the players in either don't always view us as being one of them. We've been straddling the line for 39 years. And as a result, even though we have great expertise in this space, now that it's coming up again as a big issue, some of the key players in the environmental movement or in the ag movement don't really understand what we have to bring to bear. But we're gaining traction, and of course, what makes it easier is that this is the issue of our day. And so my staff and my board live and breathe this, and we are so committed and passionate about it.
I find it interesting because as we talked about using engagement points, and all different stakeholders have different mm-hmm. levels of engagement. You're mentioning some that were quite interesting. The same practices of expressing to the farmer it's going to cost less, input mm-hmm. costs go down, mm-hmm. the values of putting the soil health at the top of the discussion list is essential for kind of a future production model. But the fact that also then meshes with where consumers are headed about worrying about the environmental issues, the best practices involved, and how they link up. So I want to talk to you a little more about that side of it, because one, in the modern food movement, there's been some other places that have seen some interest. I kind of joke that I've heard from my investor and venture friends that the future of food production will be all hydroponics and shipping containers.
Right.
It'll be
lab-grown
meat, mm-hmm. maybe some 3D mm-hmm. printed food, mm-hmm. and heck, hey, maybe that Willy Wonka and Violet Beauregard had a visionary of the three-course gum, right? Mm, the whole thing all
exactly.
wrapped up. So how do we take that enthusiasm of a modern food movement and hone it into reality of scale, required resources,
right.
proper resource management, and planetary boundaries?
Yeah. No, it's a great question, and I have people come to me all the time and say the same thing. Oh, it's a shame we're losing farmland, but are we really going to need it in the future? And the answer is yes, but I don't want to throw any cold water on folks. I think hydroponics is great. I think a lot of what's happening in urban agriculture and vertical farms and the like is great. Laboratory meat, I'm not quite there yet, but maybe I will be. I think we need it all. This is a time of experimentation where we need to look at a lot of things. But you use the word scale. And the truth is that the amount of vertical farming and opportunities like that, they work relatively well for a few very high-value crops, be it greens, maybe certain kinds of vegetables. There's not a lot of our land that's devoted to those things. Those are not what takes up the bulk of our land. So even if those expand exponentially in the next 20, 30 years, we are still going to need our underlying land resource to grow grains and to grow other crops that really only grow well in a different manner. And as population increases, which it is going to, there's only going to be more and more demand. So it's not an either or kind of thing. I think we need both. And I think even as hydroponics or vertical farming increase in activity, it is not going to increase at a level that is going to remove the amount of land we have that's growing food, and our population is just going to keep that up. Beyond that, though, and even though I'm an engineer by training, and my alma mater down the street might sometimes wonder because I might sound like a Luddite at times, but I do feel strongly that this is an area where technology alone can't solve the problems. And I also I think about the simplicity, the beauty, and the efficiency of a natural system. I mean, having land that grows crops works And it also provides a whole range of amazing environmental benefits at the same time. If you take a big picture, holistic look at things, it's hard for me to imagine how growing a lot of vegetables under lights in buildings can, in a big way, be as efficient of our resources as a natural system that works.
Hmm. It is fascinating, too, because we look at things like we think that we have to control natural order to be the engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we understand, appreciate it? I still have yet to see the replication of photosynthesis happen by man-made, right? And the most simplistic thing that happens everywhere you look out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And we still haven't been able to. So we want to control everything rather than understanding how systems and how we can link ourselves back into those systems.
Couldn't agree with you more. And you have the background that you have in soils. I mean, soils are an area where miracles happen, and we barely understand them.
Yeah.
So I couldn't agree with you more. There's such the opportunity for us to mimic natural systems or to build upon them, I think, makes a lot more sense than us trying to control them.
Yeah. And I also, when we look at just the, as you're saying, scale, I mean, I think people don't understand or appreciate what the vast scale of global agriculture, or domestic agriculture is. And yes, we get a lot of headline news about what's happening with lab-grown meat, but there's a lot of people that are forcing that forward because they will benefit if that moves forward.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a lot of news around that, but we process 9 billion animals a year in this country alone.
Right.
Right. And there's been a couple hundred million, maybe upwards of a billion investment into lab. We got a long way.
There's a lot
of opportunity to do things better rather than replacing the whole system, right?
I could not agree more.
So let's talk a little bit more about, you had mentioned one of the questions you get often is around population growth.
Mm-hmm.
So currently 29% of the Earth's surface is land. Most of it's water-based. And then we've got a situation that, as you mentioned, 10% is land that's arable, which is suitable for growing crops. To meet the needs of global population, reach over 9.5 billion by 2050, according to the UN, we'll need a 70% increase to keep pace. Is it, does that take place between the ears? Is that what we have to do? Because we got it. We just have to figure out a better way of getting people engaged. And can that happen from the Victory Garden all the way up through, you know, teaching nutrition and values of better quality food, and then obviously government resources that back up that better food?
I think you're right. It requires a variety of different strategies here. There's no magic bullet. There's no answer. There's multiple answers. I think part of it is people growing more of their own food where they can. That first off contributes in a bigger way than some people imagine it could. But if you look at the statistics, for instance, on what this nation produced with the Victory Gardens during World War II, it was significant. So I think that's part of it. It also has the additional ancillary benefit of whenever people get connected to food and grow it, I think they learn and appreciate other things. Certainly you appreciate sometimes the amazing job farmers do when you can't produce that year in and year out with the same quality and efficiency. So that's part of it. I think part of it is obviously I wouldn't be doing my organization proud if I didn't say part of it is also making sure we maintain as much farmland as we possibly can, because we're going to need it in the future, and we follow the best practices on that land, so we serve a whole range of values, not for just for food production, but for the environment. It also is a little bit about technology, and there's a lot of fights that people have over technology and food, and I'm not crazy about going down that path today. If you want to ask the questions, you can. But the point is, we have seen huge increases in food productivity over the last 100 years. And the so-called Green revolution has had some downsides. Environmental degradation, excessive use of synthetic fertilizers, and a fossil-based economy, things that have been bad. But at the same time, there would be a lot of people who wouldn't be on this planet and alive right now if it hadn't happened. We will see productivity increases. I think things like precision agriculture, where we're just being smarter about where we apply inputs, how we apply water, it's a matter of doing things more efficiently. There are going to be productivity enhancements, and that's a good thing because we're going to need every bit. In order to meet that demand for food, we're going to need to keep our land, we're going to need to grow smarter, we're going to need to have more people doing their own thing, and we're going to need a certain amount of technology. But if we lose, the more land we lose, what it does is it puts pressure on the remaining land to be used more intently. So if you are opposed to, you know, more crazy or synthetic oriented or fossil fuel dependent means of agriculture, one of the best things you can do is make sure there is more land available. Because if you think about it, every time we lose an acre of farmland, it basically means that the remaining land has to be used that much more intently for food production. And the thing a lot of people don't realize is the beauty of farming is you can both raise this amazing product. You can produce food that sustains us at the same time that you provide a whole range of wonderful environmental services, be that water recharge or wildlife habitat or sequestering carbon. You can do both, but you can't maximize both on the same piece of property. You can just optimize them, yeah. Right? So if you are forced to get the absolute most food you can out of an acre, it comes at some environmental cost.
I'm glad you brought up water, too. I mean, that's such a key part. We think of like 70% utilization in agriculture, but it's something essential for everyday life that we take for granted. It's just going to be there, right?
Yep.
We don't even treat it as a commodity.
Yep.
You know, it's lower than it because it's just been there. It's to that point of what we were speaking of earlier in my 45 years on the planet, how drastically things have changed. In this next period, we're going to see a drastic change where water is going to become an oil.
It is indeed.
Right.
It is indeed. Yep. And those are all interconnected, right?
All interconnected.
Water, food, development, land. I mean, all these. I mean, the bigger issue, of course, is just the wise use of the resources that are before us. And for many years, for eons, people didn't necessarily have to worry about it the same way because it seemed unlimited. But those days are over.
Yeah. Let me read a little bit more about your background. So, John Piatti joined American Farmland Trust as president and CEO in July of 2016, bringing more than 25 years of executive management and public policy expertise to the organization. Prior, John served as president and CEO of Maine Farmland Trust for 10 years, as you had mentioned. Under his leadership, Maine Farmland Trust became the award-winning statewide nonprofit organization, helping over 500 Maine farms remain viable. Piatti has earned a reputation as a nonpartisan problem solver, as a statesman, and as a leader in future food that has helped stabilize a regional dairy industry to procure funding to protect working waterfronts and our natural lands. John holds 3 degrees from MIT in engineering, public policy, and management. So, what got you into food and production in the first place?
Well, I've always been into food. That's part of being growing up in a good Italian family.
Absolutely.
But I can tell you about how I got into agriculture, and then I can tell you how I got into working and focusing more on land-related issues. The agricultural piece is a, I don't know how much of my life story you want, but you're about to get it. I'm ready. So I actually grew up when I was quite young in the Boston area, not too far from where we're sitting right here. And my father, quite tragically, was killed. And we are from a family of sailors, and my mother was looking for escapism, as she well deserved at that point. Picked up the family when I was 11, moved us to Nantucket Island, of all places, which is a very different world in the 60s and 70s than what it became, what it is today. And it was wonderful. It was a wonderful healing place, being part of a close-knit community. Fast forward several years, I was my mother had moved up. My stepfather, she remarried a ninth generation Islander, which is about what you need to be part of that community. But my stepfather had passed away when I was in high school. My sisters were all older; they had moved off Iowa. My mother moved off Iowa when I was in college, and it dawned on me when I was down there during a reflective summer between college and graduate school. Nantucket had just gone through this huge boom in sort of the very early 80s, and a lot of places went through that at that stage. Nantucket, there were probably a couple of extra zeros added on to what occurred with property inflation and the like. But it dawned on me that even if I wanted to go back to my home, and I would have loved to have gone back, I couldn't. There weren't opportunities for me, and I could never afford to be in that community. And I on reflection, it dawned on me that rural places do one of two things. They either wither on the vine and become sort of economic ghost towns, or they become hip and trendy and overpriced, as my home had done. But either way, it's really hard for local people to go back there and have a life, to make a life. Anyway, my mother's family is originally from Maine. A couple of my sisters were in Maine when I finished graduate school, and I moved there, grabbing my then fiance and soon to be wife with me. She was from Vermont, where southwestern Vermont, where a very similar thing was occurring in her hometown as had occurred in mine on Nantucket. Anyway, we settled in Maine, and my focus was going to be on helping rural places sustain themselves without ruining the place. So that if local people wanted to stay there, there would be an economic means. And I started working with small metalworking manufacturers, and I had an engineering degree from MIT, so I knew about different topics, and I did some stuff with aquaculture and a few other things. To make a long story short, I ended up serving on the local comprehensive plan committee with a dairy farmer. And as only a farmer can do, he, over time, as he sort of sized me up, decided I wasn't that terrible. I might have been from away, but I wasn't that bad. But he challenged me. He said, John, you say you care about rural economies and rural places, and you know absolutely nothing about farming. And he was right. We had always had a big garden growing up, and we put up vegetables, you know, so that level of, I knew nothing about farming, and I sort of subscribed to the same view that almost everyone in New England had 30 years ago, which was farming was the past, and it really didn't have any future. But he became the first of several mentors, and as I learned more and more, I had an epiphany, and it went from thinking that there was no future for farming in a place like New England to recognizing that it is one of the few things that is literally rooted here. And if we're serious about sustainable community development, it has to be grounded in sustainable agriculture. So for almost 30 years, that has been my focus. And I'm really proud of what the work that myself and several other people, I certainly stood on the shoulders of some early giants, did to help create the local food movement in Maine, which then Maine and Vermont were really the leaders in some way nationally in this. So that's how I got into the ag space. And my first role with farming was at a community development corporation and helping write business plans and doing market development work and stuff like that. And then 20 years ago, we saw maps that American Farmland Trust had produced showing the threats to farmland, particularly in southern and coastal Maine. Mm-hmm. And you know, all of us had seen the farm that disappeared and were concerned about that open field that had become house lots or a shopping mall. But we had never had the information that sort of quantified it before. AFT gave us that data. They gave us maps and information. And that was the genesis of founding a Maine Farmland Trust. We went to AFT. They gave us some information, some support. They gave us some ideas, and we found Maine Farmland Trust that I was an early founder of, and then later took over. Several years later, took over as their president. Hmm. But it dawned on me then that even though the market work that I was doing, the help with helping farmers sort of develop new markets. You know, have to remember that 30 years ago, there were no CSAs.
Right.
People weren't doing direct marketing. All that stuff had to be created. In fact, one time for several years, I had a graphic artist on staff who did nothing but produce logos and signage for farms in Maine because farms weren't doing direct marketing before then. And she was so good that she probably did this for over 200 farms in Maine. And I don't know if any of them realized they were all done by the same person, but they were pretty phenomenal.
Wow.
But I went from realizing that that was important to recognizing that if we didn't have the land, everything else we did ultimately was not going to be sustainable either.
Yeah.
So I made a switch from writing business plans to writing conservation easements.
Hmm. So let's continue. I'll pull that thread a little bit about that touch point of actually the direct marketing, getting people kind of mm-hmm. engaged and really appealing to the consumer base. Because I think it's one of the things that maybe people know your organization but may not know where it comes from. But so things like Baby on Board, My Kid is an Honor Student, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, so MAD, or the Peace Sign, or the Jesus Fist, or Coexist. These are all iconic bumper stickers mm-hmm. that are there. The single statements say volumes about mm-hmm. something that you're trying to get across in your messaging. And the original social marketing campaign that went viral and trended across American roadways, right? I mean, these things, you could see them everywhere. And right up there with these iconic pieces of engaged Americana is a Hunter Green American Farmland Trust, No Farms, No Food,
mm-hmm.
bumper sticker.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that has been so successful for getting free advertising space on people's private property all over the country? And is it do you think it's the fact that it's, you know, we know we have some issues, so it's a call to action or maybe even a cry for
mm-hmm.
help?
Mm-hmm. I don't know the psychological fundamentals behind it. I know that we've distributed over a million of those in the last 25 plus years that the tagline has existed. It's funny, a lot of people know the line, No Farms, No Food. They have no idea that American Farmland Trust is behind it.
Right.
And that's in part because we have kept a low profile, lower than we should have over these years. It's also because it's often stolen by others, and we don't mind that. If anyone's listening who has a bumper sticker of their organization, we will license it to you free. But we do like to know who is using it.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating. It has resonated with people. I do hear some folks say, but it's so negative, right? It's in fact one of the many spin-offs of it is yes farms, yes food, which I love as well. But it really resonates with many farmers because a lot of farmers feel threatened, for lack of a better word, and feel that the eating public and the general public don't necessarily understand what they do and they contribute. But I'll tell you, Aaron, we're not going to change it. We love it, but we recently have been augmenting it. So in some settings, I talk about no farms, no food, no future, because it's more than food at this point. I mean, that's really what we're learning with the recent research, that we need our farmland not just to grow our food, but in order to provide a whole range of environmental services. And in fact, I'd posit that we will, long before we run out of enough land to grow our food, we will run out of enough land to provide all of the environmental services that society needs.
Mm.
So no farms, no food still resonates, but sometimes we have been augmenting it and saying no farms, no food, no future. Still maybe a little negative, but we hope to turn, I mean, the message might sound negative because it's got a couple of no's in there, but in many ways, the story of agriculture can be very optimistic because, first off, it's about food, which is one of those amazing things that brings people together, that you can celebrate around, and that is just so wonderful. But second, farms can be part of the solution to many of our challenges in society.
Hmm. Yeah, you got to have some shock and awe here. You only had a couple seconds to look at people's bumper stickers, and some people are littered all over the place. They got to have something on there that strikes
a fancy,
right?
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. Maybe it's fresh in my mind because we just had a board meeting this weekend, and part of the board meeting was an event with some members of the public, and that was a point that was noted.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. What can we expect to see from American Farmland Trust in the next couple of years?
Well, the big thing that I'm excited about is taking our research to the next level. The Farms Under Threat report that you mentioned is all that's come out so far is phase one of a three-phase study. Phase two will be out this fall. Phase three, probably a year later. Phase two is going to have state-by-state details, as well as a policy scorecard that looks at what each state is doing to address these issues and points out where there are shortcomings. Phase three, in another year and a half or so, phase three is going to have a projective analysis, which will allow not only us, but the land trusts we work with, academics, state departments of agriculture, to use this tool to look at alternative scenarios of real estate development, and also to look at what's happening with climate change. This we have this modeled with a major climate study, so we'll be able to look at the impacts of lowered precipitation and higher heat and rising sea levels directly on ag. So those are the next things that are in the works now. But I alluded to earlier where I really want to see this research go. I mentioned at the outset, AFT is about the land, the practices, and the people. Everything I just mentioned on the research sounds like it's only about the land. But our next step, and again, it's my engineering background. I refer to it as the unified theory of conservation agriculture. We want to connect those three things. And the prime way that we connect the land with the practices is, as I was saying before, looking at how much land are we going to need if we are truly following climate smart best practices on our property. And then it relates to this issue of farmers. Because, you know, the bottom line is, if you don't have the right stewards on the land, if you don't have the right people with enough hands on the ground, enough eyes on the dirt, you cannot farm well. And we have a huge demographic crisis that we're confronting as well in American agriculture. It's not just that we're losing land. It's not just that we're not practicing the best farming practices to help restore our planet. It's also demographic. We estimate that about 370 million acres of American farmland will be in transition in the next 15 years due simply to the age of the farmland owner. Right. So we need to get more people, young people in particular, engaged in farm, and they want to do it. There's no shortage of people who want to, but there are huge barriers, many of them financial, that we need to overcome.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, as you mentioned, the idea of succession as things continue to get split and split has been a challenge as in any developed country that happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, where can our listening audience learn more about what you're doing now at American Farmland Trust and these future programs and projects that you're launching?
Sure. Well, you can go to our website. Having said that, we will have a new website up in literally 10 days. But you can go today if you want. it's farmland.org. So www.farmland.org.
Great. I will include a link, and probably by the time this hits iTunes, you'll be with that.
We'll
nice,
be fresh.
Shiny. Is it the same woman up in Maine that branded all of the Maine farms, or you got somebody
no,
else?
No. She
the new designer.
She's moved on to something else, and we have others working on these things.
Fair enough. Well, I'll just close by saying, you know, I'm enthused and excited by everything you said. This is about systems change and better design through food.
Mm-hmm.
It's about connecting with natural order and us being part of that natural order instead of just trying to control it. And we need these underlying land resources to work with the people, the stakeholders, and the practices as a unified effort. So folks, get out there, get your bumper stickers, support a whole range of environmental services and food in our future. So John Piotti, thank you so much for taking the time. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Aaron. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.